I'm Bill Radke. Hello and welcome. Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review, now at noon. So it's got to be better. Anytime there's an improvement, if it's new, it's always improved, right? Knut Berger from Crosscut, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Bill.
Same,
good to be here.
Good that you're the same mossback that
yep.
you always be.
Yeah, I haven't changed, except at noon I'm hungry. I want a ham sandwich.
Eli Sanders with The Stranger. Hey, Eli.
Hey.
Associate editor, Pulitzer Prize winner. Good to see you.
Nice to be here.
Joni Balter, Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail. Great to see you in the noon hour.
Good noon to you.
Good noon to you. And we want to welcome a guest for the next few minutes here, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Arsalan Bukhari. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited to have you here. This is certainly this week the conversation has been about this, the idea of resettling Syrian refugees in Washington State. There is, in fact, a rally going on right now in Olympia. There's a group opposed to the idea of settling Syrian refugees here, and we have our Capitol reporter, Austin Jenkins, with us live there at the Capitol. Austin, what's going on with this rally right now?
Oh, hi, Bill. I would say that there are a few dozen activists or protesters, actually, on both sides of this issue. They've set up two protests, one on the steps of the state Capitol and one on the steps of the Supreme Court. The folks on the steps of the Supreme Court are chanting that they welcome refugees here. The folks here on the steps of the Capitol where I'm standing are basically saying that there needs to be some guarantee of security before we allow more refugees in, specifically Syrian refugees.
Yes, this group that I've seen is called Act for America, who say they're dedicated to national security and defeating terrorism. What specific security steps are they calling for when it comes to resettling Syrian refugees here? Because we have a lot of security already. There's a big, long screening process.
Right, and they basically are saying that current screening process is not adequate. They are of the belief that basically for the moment there should be no refugees allowed access because they don't have faith that this screening process is sufficient. They are certainly referencing today's terrorist attack. They're referencing what happened in Paris. And they're basically, there was interesting dialogue, if you can call it that, more like angry words, I would say, between the two sides before these rallies started, where really the question became and where the disagreement seemed to be is whether, at this point, whether there is space that our government can keep us safe. And clearly those who are saying, welcome the refugees, feel like that can be done and we can be welcoming people in need. And those who are standing here on the steps of the Capitol are saying, no, it's too risky. We are at a time of war, one woman said, and we have to close our borders at this moment in time.
We are at a time of war. Okay, that's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins at the state Capitol. Thank you, Austin.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, at the state Supreme Court, it sounds like on the steps of the Supreme Court, there's a rally on behalf of the idea of resettling Syrian refugees here, as Governor Inslee called for this week, by the way. And he's an exception. More than half of the governors across America said that we should stop accepting Syrian refugees. And the way this came about is that there were reports that at least one of the terrorists in this deadly attack in Paris had posed as a Syrian refugee in order to get into Europe. We don't know that. In fact, the identities of the terrorists that have been confirmed, all those attackers held European Union passports. Governor Inslee heard these dozens of American governors say, keep them out, and he strongly disagreed.
I've always believed my state and the country has always been a place of refuge from those who are persecuted. Right on the Statue of Liberty, they talk about the wretched refuge of your teeming shore. And I don't know where we've had more people who fit this classification of victims.
Now, this is a somewhat symbolic protest since governors don't have the legal authority to stop people coming here legally. Meanwhile, a Republican Washington state legislator went beyond Syrian refugees and said on Facebook that, quote, Islam is incompatible with Western civilization. The state Democratic Party has demanded that Snoqualmie Representative Jay Rodney be removed from his seat on the House Judiciary Committee. Jay Rodney, Republican, not from Eastern Washington, Republican from Snoqualmie in King County. We invited Representative Jay Rodney to come on the show, and to my shock, he said yes, and you were going to get to hear him tell you why Islam is incompatible with Western civilization, and why would he say that President Obama, quote, wants to import 1.5 million Muslims into the United States, which is not what the president has ever said. But just before the show or in the last hour, a representative from Jay Rodney's office corrected said what I really expected all along, which was he will not be coming on. So we just have a clip of him talking on Seattle's Q13 TV, joining this call for a halt to resettlement of Syrian refugees.
You know, the vast majority of Muslims in the world are peaceful and want nothing more than to live in peace with other faiths. Unfortunately, there's a small percentage of that 1.5 billion Muslim practitioners who ascribe to a medieval interpretation of their faith that commands them to commit acts of atrocity against our civilization. Radical Islam is at war against us. And we have a serious security issue because we cannot differentiate between who is a peaceful refugee who wants nothing more than to come to our country and enjoy the freedoms and live in peace and enjoy economic prosperity with the terrorist who wants to come and exploit our freedoms against us. And quite honestly, the people of France have been disarmed by their government. Had there been concealed carry individuals, perhaps that theater where 100 people were massacred one by one would have been ended much more abruptly and quickly and in the favor of civilization. So that's the problem. We cannot differentiate. And until, you know, we can have a reliable vetting program, it's reckless to allow unvetted Syrian migrants into the country.
Listening to this conversation all week long about terrorists and Muslims, and sometimes being conflated, the two being conflated, as the Council on American Islamic Relations, Arsalan Bukhari. Arsalan, what do you have to say about what you've heard this week?
Well, I think the first thing we should know is that there's thousands of children growing up right in Jay Rodney's district. There are over 1,000 Muslims who live in his own district who are law-abiding citizens. They pay their taxes. They are Americans. And I think we're hoping for an opportunity for him to meet these children and these families and these mothers and learn about the hopes and dreams they have for their future and hear from those children the kind of message that his conversations about Muslims sends to those kids. Those kids are hearing over this whole week that somehow they're second class when lawmakers and elected officials should be sending a message to these children that they have the same rights, same opportunities, same hopes and dreams as any other young American. So I think, you know, the facts on the ground contradict what he's saying. The message to children is just so dangerous, and that needs to be corrected.
Now, in this conversation on Q13, he was presented with his Facebook comments, and he more or less, he really didn't address them at all. So he didn't delete his post. He didn't say, I'm sorry for what I said. But he's not continuing to say things like Islam is incompatible with Western civilization. So, but those are the comments that have state Democrats calling for him to be stripped of his committee position. So I want to know, how much does it mean that he got onto Facebook and said what he said to you? If he's no longer continuing to say it, how much does it matter to you?
So here's the analogy I'll make. If someone said that they say the worst things about African-American culture and then say, well, you know, I love African-American people, but the culture, and then say all the bad things about that, we would see right through it. We would not say that this person is somehow fair-minded. We would see right through it. And in the same way, when someone says things about Islam, but then couches, kind of hides behind a friend they have who's Muslim, we've got to see right through it also. I think that's unfair. It shows a lack of understanding of everyday American families. I think what he should know is that there's between 10 and 20,000 American Muslims serving today honorably in our armed forces. And thousands more serving as law enforcement right here in Seattle and many more cities. So again, the comments he's making, we should see right through them. We should see the bigotry in those comments. And we should then turn the corner and help him understand through those families' words and stories the real-life consequences that his words are having on those kids today and the reality on the ground, the American Muslims who are part and parcel of our society.
Beyond the question of Syrian refugees and Washington State commenters, we've had Donald Trump, still the front runner, right up there with Ben Carson, saying this week that all Muslims should register. There should be a database, a registry, and Muslim Americans should have to register. How do you take these kind of comments? How much do you see it as dismissible political theater, and how much does it truly bother you in the gut, Arsalan Boukhari?
So I think the real thing is not just the message it sends to children, but the kind of violence it inspires against everyday people. We've seen hate crimes reported once a day, every day, on average, from somewhere in the nation to some care office in the nation. So that's a real story here, I think, is the real-life consequences of his words on children and families. And again, the imagination of these children who are growing up across the country, there's millions of American children who are Muslim or look Muslim across our nation, and the message it sends to them is a very dangerous message, that somehow they're less than. And again, he needs to be sending the message that they have the right to the same hopes and dreams as every other young American, and that they can grow up to be productive citizens of our nation.
From the Council on American Islamic Relations, that's Arsalan Boukhari. From the stranger, Eli Sanders, how seriously are you taking the conversation you've heard in America and Washington State this week?
Very seriously. I mean, talking about people of a religious group having to register sounds to me like Nazi Germany, you know, saying in an undifferentiated way that all people of one religion are this sounds like what we've heard before time and again in countries that have really done horrible things to people. I don't know. I have a hard time talking about it. It's so upsetting, you know. I think probably a number of us in this room are the children of immigrants or grandchildren of immigrants. I am. My grandparents came here fleeing war. And, you know, in that period, there was also this kind of fear and hysteria. And it's hard to see. People do, you know, terrible things out of fear. We know that. It's hard to think rationally, maybe at a time like this. But it's disgusting what people like J. Rodney are doing. It's just flat out demagoguery. He's playing on racial prejudice or anti-religious bigotry. I don't know why he's doing it, because I'm not sure what he thinks it furthers. But it's classic demagoguery preying on people's fears and hatreds. And someone on the Judiciary Committee to be so injudicious with his comments, I mean, I think that it's a good idea to get him off that committee.
I think there's quite a lot of weight to the fact that J. Rodney chose not to come on this show. In other words, his comments, he was not in the mood to repeat them.
By the way, his office said it was a scheduling conflict.
I know it was. On Facebook, you know, he proved a couple things in there. He can't add, he can't spell. I mean, I know not everybody's Facebook posts are edited or vetted or anything like that, but there was some sloppy stuff in there, and the numbers were absurd. The number of Muslims that Obama was supposedly welcoming was just not the right number. He used this number, the millions, when it's 10,000.
What do you make of all that? That his comments were just flip and therefore meaningless?
Flip, and maybe he should have taken the Facebook post down because he seems to be backtracking without saying I'm backtracking. And I think we should all be pretty darn proud this week of Governor Jay Inslee. You know, he's not known as the most eloquent spokesman, but here he did, in the tradition of Washington, think about the tradition of this state. Former Governor Dan Evans is famous for welcoming Vietnamese refugees when it wasn't that popular a thing to do. And then Secretary of State Ralph Monroe, he's with the kilt-wearing branch of the Republican Party, mm-hmm. as many people who know him would agree. And then he followed up with that. And so this state has a history of being welcoming, and I believe that in part inspired Jay Inslee, who also mentioned the unfortunate history here. He lives on Bainbridge Island, which is where some of the first activities were to intern Japanese folks. And so I think we should all be darn proud of Jay Inslee, because he bucked the trend of governors, none of whom are going to actually block people. That was just talk.
And the governor has a very strong op-ed in the New York Times today that's worth reading, where he recapitulates all of what Joni just said.
He was on NPR's Morning Edition this week in the New York Times. And if you have not heard Ralph Monroe tell the story of Dan Evans calling him up and sending him to Camp Pendleton in Southern California to bring Vietnamese refugees here because nobody else wanted them, it is amazing. We aired it some time ago and re-aired it again this week, and you can find it at our website, Ralph Monroe, Vietnamese refugees. He really, really is amazing retelling of a story. To the like, I listened thinking, I didn't know it actually happened like that, that a governor would hear Jerry Brown's comments in California and say, this is bunk. Get down there and find out what's going on. And Ralph Monroe describes him showing up and telling this military commander, we'll take them. And this commander, are you serious? And being relieved, you know, and he walking among the tents and meeting people who, of course, their children and grandchildren are here. Speaking of history, Knute Berger, what do you think is the right analogy as we consider the history of Washington State and refugees and what's happening today with the Syrian refugee debate?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me is, you know, all the historical examples that are coming up, the internment, Nazi Germany, and that kind of thing. People are it's like the American amygdala is firing up and everybody's kind of reaching for analogies. And it's striking the contradictions that are in some of the positions. If so-called radical Islam is the enemy, why would we not help people who are fleeing the enemy? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't.
Right. If it's an ally war analogy.
We want refugees vetted at a level that the same people refuse to vet our citizens when it comes to buying guns. In other words, you know, there are these contradictions about, you know, how much of a national security state is there and who's it for? Is it only for people of color? Is it only for people that you don't like? I thought also the Seattle Times had a great map today that showed the thousands of refugees from Islamic countries that are here already that have been resettled from Iraq and Somalia and other places. You know, I think most of us feel that it's seamless, you know, that people that we have. So it's like they're fearing something that's already happened and been proven to be fine. We have, you know, the Pacific Northwest has really a terrible racial history, and it's a history we really don't want to think about. There's a reason that cities like Seattle and Portland are among the whitest in the country. It was by design, at least partly by design. A lot of settlers moved here to get away from the race politics of the pre-Civil War era and the Civil War era. They didn't want to end slavery, but they wanted to get away from the fight over slavery. And so states like Oregon passed racial exclusion laws that said no black or mulatto could live in the state of Oregon. The Chinese exclusion was another thing where we refused to allow Chinese to become citizens. Then we tried to literally bodily ship them out. Seattle at one time banned all Native Americans from the city. You know, we have two Americas. One is the America of the Statue of Liberty, and the other is the America that when we freak out, we immediately blame the other.
Let's talk more about racial politics and this debate we're having in a moment. We just told you about the rally going on in the steps of the state capitol right now against the idea of resettling Syrian refugees here. On Saturday, November 28th, so a week from this Saturday, there's going to be a rally for refugees at Westlake, organized by Americans for Refugees and Immigrants, hashtag Refugees Welcome. That's Saturday, the 28th of November at 2 o'clock. This is KUOW's Week in Review. And on the subject of racial politics and the argument we've been having this week and this year, the Space Needle this week flew the French flag in solidarity with France after the deadly terrorist attacks there. The Space Needle is not flying the flag of Mali today, where at least 18 people were just killed in a hostage siege. A group that split from Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility. The Space Needle didn't fly the flag of Lebanon, Pakistan, Kenya, etc. Stranger writer, editor Charles Mudede told KUOW this week that this is racist. He said it's understandable. He said it's human. He didn't even say the flag should come down. He said, let's recognize, though, how comfortable we feel about caring more about Europe, about the West, about Christians, about light-skinned people.
The USA does feel closer to France than it would to Beirut and to other countries around the world. I sort of accept that. But we do it naturally, and this is the problem. And for me, I have to find the language that sort of makes it clear why it is not that natural and why it is problematic that we try to express our solidarity with France in light of other tragedies that have happened around the world and often to people who are not of the same color as many of the victims in the situation in France.
Charles admitted there was a little bit, he had his own internal debate about the clickbaitness of saying, is the Seattle Space Needle French flag racist? But he decided that was that's the language we were talking, and that's the way to get people to think about this. Did anybody think the headline was a bad idea and that that expressing solidarity for the grieving people of France is not in the least racist?
Well, let's do a little bit of history here, too. You know, France was America's first ally, and it was a very important ally. This was, as many people are saying, this was not... I hate to get to the point where like, oh, well, what happened in Mali or Lebanon was sort of lesser, but this was France's 9/11, a lot of people think. I'm an and person. Put all the flags up there and put, you know, change the lights if that makes folks.
But how literal is that? I mean, some people said, we heard this week, put the flag of Syria there, put the flag of Iraq there. You know, let's really show we care about a lot of. So when you say any and all flags, I just want to know what you're suggesting.
Well, I say that and I believe that. I think we could add any and all flags. And yet I also think we have to be very careful about our ists and isms that we throw around here in this very tolerant and open-minded community. You know, it was just, what was it, this summer that the reason we had to, you know, upzone all the single-family neighborhoods in Seattle was because we are at our core racist and unfair. Really? Talk to people. Are they really? I mean, I think he's making a fine point, and yet you got to dole this out very sparingly and very carefully, because there is real racism and there is real anti-religious fervor, but call it when it's really that.
I'll start with the brownest person in the room and the Muslim in the room. Arsalan Bukhari is with us from the Council on American Islamic Relations. Any reaction?
You know, I think I don't really know. I mean. So France, what happened in France, you know, is deplorable. It was tragic. All of our hearts go out to the families who had family members who were victims in that attack. But I think, yeah, I think we can fly more flags, especially when things happen, and especially to sort of recognize the tragedies that happen in other countries also.
Is there anything you want to say to listeners as we are having this? You're right, Joni. This is a continuing conversation that, as we talked about before the microphones went on, I've seen it in email to KOW this week. We've had conversations this week that are making people in the majority in this country, in this state, feel uncomfortable. And so we've been asking, when is that a good thing? And when is, maybe as you're suggesting, when are we overreaching, Joni, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be careful with it.
So let's go around. Arsalan, any opinion?
You know, I think the questions that come up when these sorts of things happen are not really much about politics. It's about who we are as people, right? So who we are as people and how we as people treat others. And I think that's a role that everyone has to play. That's a thought that everyone should have when they take actions. I, as a person who is a racial as part of a racial minority, think about how others who are unlike myself would like to be treated, would like to be talked about. I think that's not just for me, it's for everybody else too.
I was sitting here thinking, if we were to put the Mali flag on top of the Space Needle today, does anyone in the room know the colors of the Mali flag?
Nope.
You could educate us, Eli. We're open-minded.
I don't either, but I think that goes to Charles's point about what he was really trying to do with that post. The segment that you did with him is really worth listening to. It goes on for 9 minutes, so it's hard to really summarize, but you're right. He did say, you know, the word racism for him was kind of a shorthand for the discussion about the ongoing misunderstanding between the so-called West and the so-called East, or you could just substitute the word other. And that there's just, for many historical reasons, a greater familiarity or sense of familiarity and solidarity between the United States and France, and that doesn't exist between the United States and other countries. For example, none of us could even conjure up the image of the Mali flag right now. And so I think that point that Charles is making is an important one to hear. And he's not the first to make that. This discussion about the misunderstandings, the perpetual misunderstandings that, by the way, people like J. Rodney and ISIS exploit between West and East. I mean, this discussion has been going on for a very long time. I just reminded myself of something I wanted to say a minute ago about J. Rodney. He is basically, in one of the, you know, ironies that we could add to the list that Knut was making earlier, J. Rodney has come around and agrees with ISIS that Islam is incompatible with modernity.
So Eli's making, yes, Joni.
So let me ask you this question, since you've taken this position. Is Seattle called racist when it is racist, or sometimes when it isn't racist?
By who? And I mean,
yeah,
who am I answering for here?
To
you. I'm answering to you. But who am I explaining to you? I mean, it's, you go on social media and there's no lack of people calling other people racist. That's a big
that's why it waters it down.
Occupation of a lot of people now. And so I can't tell you whether everyone who's lodged that criticism is doing it fairly. I mean, I don't want to like adjudicate that. But I think we would all agree that we can improve our relationship between different relationships between different racial groups in this state and in this country, and that, you know, this dialogue that you're talking about, Bill, is one that makes people uncomfortable but worth having. I mean, it's also, I guess, another way of putting your question is, who gets to say the conversation is the wrong one to have or too uncomfortable to be having? There's a connection there between, you know, kind of the dominant group in society, power, and so on. We start to sound like a liberal arts college class when we start talking about this, and people kind of roll their eyes. But it's not unimportant. And okay, Charles's point was not unimportant.
Bring your eyes back down, because we have many other top stories of the week to get to in the next, what's left of the, well, the hour is already half over. So before we say goodbye to Arsalan Bukhari, and thank you for coming in, I just want to know, because we're asking listeners and each other, Thanksgiving is coming. what is your strategy for having, do you even plan to have any awkward, volatile, potentially volatile conversations at Thanksgiving? What do you do about it?
Well, the conversations I hope to have is about the stories I hear every day. And I think that's the best thing people can do. They can talk about the lives and the contributions of the American Muslims they know in their lives. So when your uncle brings up a conversation about Syria, talk about people right here at home, these people who are building their lives here. And that's the best way to really talk about topics related to Islam and Muslims. Bring it home. There's over, you know, 100,000 or so Muslims in our own state, again, who are mainstream, part of society. And that's the best way to talk about that one topic that I would suggest to people. It's talk about people right here. Talk about the ones that you actually know through school, through work, through the gym. And that's the best way to talk about American Muslims, to your uncle, to your grandfather, to your aunt at that dinner table.
That's the last thing your uncle was expecting, for you to rear back and tell a story. A good story, a good local human story. We want to know, what is your strategy, listener, for handling uncomfortable Thanksgiving conversations? Illustrations are most welcome. 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Our Facebook page is KUOW Public Radio, and we're live tweeting the show. Let us know about any and everything that you're hearing about this hour. Make your voice heard. We are at KUOW on Twitter. Arsalan Bukhari, Counselor on American Islamic Relations, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. This week, Tim Iman anti-tax initiatives are countered with an anti-Tim Iman anti-tax initiative. Tim Iman filed paperwork this week for an initiative that would put a one-year limit on all new tax increases on top of the many measures that he sponsors, one that he passed among statewide voters this month, making it harder to raise taxes. Well, in response, the founder of the Northwest Progressive Institute will file a new statewide initiative, and they say it will require that initiatives only pass if more than 50% of registered voters participate in the election. We are talking to the founder, co-founder of the Northwest Progressive Institute, Andrew Villeneuve. Welcome to KUOW.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Why would we require, we have a constitutional process here. If you don't bother to vote, you really don't get a say in whether an initiative passes or not. Why would you want to make an initiative only pass if 50% of registered voters participate?
Well, look at it this way. In our legislature, we require that bills pass by a constitutional majority. That's in our plan of government. And what you'll find is that if you don't have enough people in the House and in the Senate to pass a bill, the bill just doesn't pass. And we have that requirement because we want our representative government to be truly representative. The idea that you have to have a constitutional majority in the House and the Senate to always pass a bill, that's a requirement that never goes away, but that a small number of the voters, a tiny number perhaps, because of bad turnout in an election, could pass a law that affects everyone, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So what we're proposing is that we amend state law to say that if a majority of voters does not vote for or against an initiative in an election, that that initiative simply won't pass. And there's already a requirement in state law that says if you have enough voters skipping an initiative or a referendum in an election, and this is the people who are turning out, then that initiative will be declared failed by the governor or referendum. So we're just modifying what's already in state law and saying, actually, we're going to change that to say that a majority of voters must vote for and against an initiative in order for that initiative or referenda to count. It doesn't pass if not enough voters turn out.
Andrew, I have a question for you. This is Joni Balter. And my question is, have you thought about voter turnout and how that would impact initiatives? They would not be able really to pass in odd years on the calendar. So 2015, what was voter turnout? Something like 36%. So there's not going to be any initiatives by this. Had you thought about that? You can only do them in even years?
We thought about that, yeah. And that's exactly what we're after. If odd-numbered year turnout is terrible, then we don't want any laws to be changed in the state of Washington, because what that essentially means is a small number of voters are making decisions for the greater number of voters. So we have a minority effectively making law in the state of Washington. If you look at I-1366, Tim Iman's initiative, which is passing very narrowly, Ron Judd did a great job in the Seattle Times sort of reframing this and saying, well, if you look at the number of registered voters who are voting for this, it's at 16%. It's since increased to 19%. But that's still an absurdly low number. 19% of the registered voters of Washington can make law and pass an initiative? That doesn't make a lot of sense. And given that the legislative process requires an absolute majority, a constitutional majority, we think it makes sense to bump up the requirement for passage of initiatives to be something more sensible. Now, an alternative approach would be just to get rid of state-level elections in odd-numbered years, because we always have more than a majority turnout in even-numbered years. If you go and look at the statistics going back to 1936, when we started permanent voter registration in Washington, we've had pretty good turnout, even in the midterm years when there was no statewide race like last year. We still get above 50%, but in some of these odd-numbered years, we've been dipping horribly below. And this year, 2015, we saw the worst turnout in state history.
Okay.
We've never had turnout this bad.
Andrew Villeneuve with the Northwest Progressive Institute behind this new statewide initiative, not yet filed, but it would say initiatives only pass if more than half of registered voters participate. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
How constitutional does this sound, Knute Berger?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting idea. Maybe it is constitutional, but people also have a constitutional right not to vote. And I guess, you know, if they want to allow a minority of people who actually do vote to make decisions, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, that may be their right. So it's intriguing. I'd have to think more deeply about it.
Okay, we got to swim fast to cover the rest of the week's news this hour. And salmon is next. GMO salmon is for real right after a break. We're covering the top stories of the week and learning from them right now with Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, Joni Balter. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Thank you for tuning in. GMO salmon is coming to a store near you. This week, the Food and Drug Administration approved the first genetically modified salmon as safe for human consumption. The fish was developed by a company called Aqua Advantage. They use growth hormone from Chinook salmon and a gene from an eel-like ocean fish to make a fish that grows fast. Reporter Cassandra Profita says it reaches market size twice as fast as other salmon.
The FDA approved production of the fish in land-based tanks at two locations, one in the east coast of Canada and the other in Panama. Nancy Fitzpatrick heads the Oregon Salmon Commission. She says her industry wants the new fish to be labeled for consumers and doesn't want them produced anywhere in Oregon.
We don't want to risk it because of the possibility of straying into our rivers and then interacting with our wild and hatchery fish.
The FDA isn't requiring the new salmon to be labeled as a genetically engineered food. Opponents are pressuring stores not to sell the fish. Some have already said they won't.
The FDA says, we don't need to label it because we already told you it's safe. The FDA says it's not going to get into the wild because it's in tanks on land in Panama and Canada. So why are you opposing the FDA's move? Marion Nestle, professor of nutrition at New York University. Welcome to KUOW.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. She writes at foodpolitics.com. If the FDA says that genetically modified salmon is safe for you and safe for the fish, what's your problem with it?
Well, the FDA is tone deaf about what the public is interested in. The FDA's view, if it's safe, there's no reason whatsoever why any rational person would oppose it. On the other hand, lots of people think that even if it's safe, there are plenty of reasons to oppose it. And those reasons include a very large range of environmental, social, religious, and other kinds of issues that people really care about.
What's the environmental issue?
The problem could be solved if they would label it, but here again, the FDA is tone deaf. And has chosen to say that the difference between genetically modified organisms and other kinds of foods is not material. And by material, they mean that there's no nutritional difference. It's a process. They don't label processes. But the FDA does label processes. It labels made from concentrate, previously frozen. It labels irradiated. Those are processes. It could label this if they want to. If they wanted to, they're not doing it for political reasons.
Well, the FDA says, and by the way, as you know, a lot of scientists say are on board with this. Saying that this includes the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the World Health Organization, the European Union. They say GMOs are safe and that requiring labels would first of all, unfairly stigmatize a process that they've declared as the FDA declared as safe, but also would discourage the production of food that we could produce with fewer resources because they eat less. That's supposedly a good thing. And that there are health benefits. For example, we could curb vitamin A deficiency. We could increase crop yields. So you don't label something that you want to, unless you want to discourage it. And the FDA is saying this is a good thing.
Well, there are plenty of labels, as I said, on processing issues made from concentrate, previously frozen. People still buy them. I think the industry brought this problem on itself in 1994 when it lobbied so strongly against labeling when it was already clear that large segments of the public wanted these things labeled. If the industry wasn't afraid and didn't feel that it had something to hide, I think this whole conversation would be completely different. They need to label it, and the FDA really made a bad mistake in not labeling it.
How reassured are you by the promise that these salmon are in tanks, on land, netted, covered, they're not going to escape?
Well, I thought the whole business about Panama was hilarious because if they do escape, they get into both oceans. They go into the Panama Canal and get into both oceans. I'm assured that the water in Panama is so warm that it will kill the fish, if not the big ships going through the Panama Canal. I'm willing to grant that they can keep them out of the water supply. I think that's really not the issue, although it is an issue, but they need to be monitored for that and watched. They're making lots of promises. Will they keep the promises? That remains to be seen.
Marion Nestle, professor of nutrition at New York University, writes at foodpolitics.com, and her books include Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda, and Winning. Professor, thanks for joining us on KUOW.
My pleasure.
So in Washington State, we had the chance to require GMO labeling, and voters said no. Anybody think this isn't coming right back onto the ballot now with GMO fish coming to you?
Well, I don't know if it'll go right back on the ballot, but I think you have to consider the way the consumers are. This does not sound delicious to me, particularly the
which part, the eel?
The gene? Eel part was I was a little high centered on the eel part. Also, don't personally like farm salmon as much as wild. But think about how people want to know: is this product organic? Is it locally grown? Where did this come from? And is it Frankenfish? You know, I think that they have a marketing challenge to people in this state for sure.
No marketing challenge if it's not labeled, right?
Exactly. I think the government has done them a big favor on that score.
Yeah. And here we have alternatives. What worries me is, you know, what this might do to the overall market for wild fish, whether it would take some of the pressure off habitat restoration. I think they're kind of, and then, of course, there's the consequences if somebody maliciously dumped some of these into the ocean.
They are female and supposedly infertile.
Right. Well, you just never know. Maybe I've seen Jurassic Park too many times, but you know what I mean.
Or who wants the job of checking that?
But what I'm saying, you know, and for me, the lack of a label just means that I'm only going to eat salmon that I absolutely know is wild.
You know, I was going to ask Professor Nestle, are you going to have uncomfortable salmon conversations at Thanksgiving. I completely forgot about it.
That would be a very non-traditional Thanksgiving meal if it involves salmon of any kind, GMO or otherwise.
Indeed. So you don't think that that GMO labeling is coming right back onto the Washington State ballot?
Well, it did.
A lot of people thought it
did so poorly. I mean, you know, it was easy to stomp on. It went down like 2-1.
That was before there were GMO salmon in your store.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and if the TV stations want the advertising revenue from the Battle Royale, it's a smart move.
Okay. So the news is this week's approval by the FDA of the first genetically modified salmon as safe for human consumption. Will you be eating it for Thanksgiving? You don't know. Because it's not going to be labeled. Some stores in the past have said that they wouldn't sell genetically modified salmon. Whole Foods and Trader Joe's have said that in the past. Haven't heard from them yet. But again, you won't know unless we require. Unless there's your way in if you want your government to require the labeling.
But people could advertise and say we do not sell this, and folks would then know where to shop.
Vote with your dollar. KUOW's Week in Review, the time is 12:50. What does Bernie Sanders say to Seattle liberals? Coming up. Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke, learning from the news of the week and live tweeting at KUOW. This week, presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders gave a speech about what it means that he is a democratic socialist. Kennedy gave his speech about being a Catholic. Mitt Romney addressed his Mormon faith. Obama gave a speech about his race. How did Bernie Sanders define democratic socialism?
Democratic socialism means that we must reform a political system which is corrupt, that we must create an economy that works for all, not just the very wealthy.
For decades, a lot of Americans felt like the word socialist meant un-American. Sanders said socialism is extremely American.
It means building on what Franklin Delano Roosevelt said when he fought for guaranteed economic rights for all Americans. And it builds on what Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1968 when he stated, and I quote, "This country has socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor," end of quote.
Here's my question. Socialism is a more viable, more realistic political choice now than it's been in a long time, especially in Seattle, where we have a socialist city council member just got reelected, which could put a Seattle liberal in an awkward position. If you're a Democrat, but you've chosen not to be a socialist, then how progressive are you really? Eli Sanders, are you a socialist?
Well, I was looking at the clips of Bernie Sanders' speech. I haven't listened to the whole thing or been able to read it, but that Bernie Sanders speech in 6 quick clips on NPR that you sent around before the show, I mean, it all sounds great to me.
So you are now a member of the Socialist Party.
They haven't come for my dues yet, so I don't know. But I think that what Bernie Sanders is saying sounds great and not all that much different than what a lot of Democrats in Seattle want.
Well, this is what I mean. If you think Bernie Sanders, and you're going to tell your like-minded friends at Thanksgiving how great Bernie Sanders is, are you a Democrat or are you a socialist? Knut, it seems like the choice is more real than it's ever been.
Well, in some ways, I mean, Bernie Sanders and Shama Sawant are different kinds of socialists. So mm-hmm. you get into splitting here. He's a Democratic socialist, and he's running within the Democratic Party structure for the primaries and whatnot. So, you know, Bernie Sanders is essentially just a very liberal Democrat, and he casts himself in the Franklin D. Roosevelt tradition.
So that's your rationalization for being a Democrat and not a socialist?
No, conservatives have called that socialism for a long time, but it's not socialism with a capital S in the sense of Shama Sawant's Socialist Alternative Party, which wants worldwide revolution. It has a very global agenda. She talked about nationalizing Boeing. Bernie Sanders is not talking about nationalizing Boeing, but it's different. However, because she's a local candidate, she can run on she runs on issues that do resonate with a lot of Democrats. So, you know, she is a socialist who's getting a lot of crossover support. Because people like her, you know, her attitude on the city council, the way she pushes it to the left. But I don't think there'd be a lot of support if she actually tried to nationalize Boeing.
Last word, Joni Balter.
Seems to me like Bernie Sanders is trying to sort of broaden the tent so that he can have some appeal, because the Gallup poll shows the word socialism is negative for, you know, about half the folks. There is a generational difference you alluded to earlier in response to the word socialism. And, you know, so baby boomers maybe just sort of have a negative response to that. But millennials, they don't have that history. They think of it as having to do more with sort of economic justice and things like that. And so I think he's trying to broaden the tent to broaden his own appeal. And can I just say that Larry David does a better Bernie Sanders than Bernie Sanders?
Yeah,
does?
Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you've got a warm place to sleep and live, unlike an estimated 17,000 people in the state. It was cold this morning, the 20s in some parts of the Sound. King County's working with the city of Seattle to make sure more homeless people get indoors during these nights.
The county has expanded shelter hours so that people can come in from the cold earlier and stay in the shelters longer. So many of the shelters are open as early as 6 o'clock in the evening. We are expanding the amount of shelter beds available throughout the county as well.
That's Adrian Quinn, director of the King County Department of Community and Human Services. The city also plans on opening an emergency winter shelter if the temperature were to drop below 20 degrees. Not only that, for next week, I've been hearing the word snow. I don't want to overhype it, which is why we asked state climatologist Nick Bond to come in. Hi, Nick.
Hey there.
Snow?
Well, yeah, it is a four-letter word after all.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to hype it. There's just there's an outside possibility of a little bit of it, probably early Tuesday or so. More to the kind of north part of the Sound and Kitsap County and so forth.
Sea level?
Well, yeah, the temperatures are kind of marginal, so more above 500 feet. But
that's Queen Anne territory, though.
Yeah, you know, it is a possibility. Now, the computer models, they promise this a lot more often than it happens.
Right.
But I wish I had a nickel for every time that's happened. But
yeah.
It is a possibility, and it does look like it's going to usher in some colder air.
Mount Baker ski area open. What is this mean for the spring-summer snowpack? How are we living?
Oh, yeah. This is not big producer of snow in the mountains.
Yeah.
And so this is more of an
But the
event.
Snow that we've had so far, are we in good shape or impossible to tell because it's November?
It's impossible to tell. And so we're just not far enough along. But I would like to point out that, you know, some serious cold next week. And so for people who are going on an early Thanksgiving trip or something, this weekend would be a good time to cover the hose bibs and wrap the pipes and bring in sensitive plants and all that. Because in the colder spots, it could get down to 20 or so.
Yeah.
Upper 20s in some of the warmer spots.
I've got the styrofoam little cozies on my faucets.
Well, that can do a lot.
I'm worried about my worms. I got compost worms. I don't think they're going to make it.
Well, and actually, all seriousness aside, the slugs take a hit when we have this cold, dry weather.
Or if you spill beer, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Their eggs are less viable if they get kind of dried out. And so here's hoping the slugs take a hit.
Okay, so is it fair to say Snowmageddon is coming on Tuesday?
No.
Oh, Snowpocalypse?
Well, no.
Snowzilla.
But if there's...
SnowMG.
Yeah.
If Kaiser Snowze. Is that a reality on Tuesday?
Well, you know, dare to dream.
Okay.
But it does look like there could be a few flurries around, and hey, let's take what we can get.
Nick Bond, state climatologist. Always good to see you. Thank you. Hey, Nick, do you have a strategy for handling uncomfortable Thanksgiving conversations?
Oh, geez. Wow.
Like, you guys always get it wrong. You said it was going to snow on Tuesday, and it didn't.
Yeah, that's right. We're so used to it.
Yeah.
Thick skin and all that.
How about the rest of you? Any advice for listeners as we go into Thanksgiving? What's your strategy?
Just shout Snowzilla.
Yeah.
Distracts them.
I found it
won't remember what they just said. On to the next topic.
Do you tackle it? Do you get around Thanksgiving and even attempt it anymore? To say something that your cousin might disagree with, that your uncle might shout you down?
For whatever reason, I'm only hanging with sort of more agreeable relatives this
You think, because you never say anything controversial.
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh, yeah? Okay. I have the strategy. Don't do it. No one cares what your opinion is. It's not worth it.
Writing that one down.
Yeah, the only opinion that matters is the gravy any good.
Tell us a story, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Bernard Ouellette, producer Jason Pagano, Nick Bond, thanks for coming in.
Yep.
We're on Twitter, @KUOW. The news coming up.